take a network break, dunk a virtual donut in a nice hot cup of coffee, and join us for our weekly romp through the landscape of IT news. We've got stories on Cisco, Citrix, VMware, an operatic open source battle, and more. We're sponsored today by Palo Alto Networks. You can enable secure access for your remote workers from anywhere with Palo Alto Networks Prisma Access, a cloud-delivered Tier 1 network. Prisma Access offers comprehensive network security in a single services edge platform designed for all traffic, all applications, and all users. You can find out more at paloaltonetworks.com/secure-remote-workforces. Stay tuned after the news. We have a sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with AppNeta. We're going to discuss how to deploy real-time monitoring so you can define and actually measure performance and ensure a good end-user experience. And last but not least, check out our Human Infrastructure newsletter. Every week, there's a packet pusher's essay on life in IT. We also scour the internet for the best tech blogs and videos from around the web. It's free to sign up at packetpusher.net/newsletter. All right, let's get to the news. Citrix is spending $2.25 billion in cash to acquire Ryke. This is a SaaS-based work collaboration company. Ryke is owned by the private equity firm Vista Equity Partners.
Yeah, a little bit weird this. Did you know Ryke existed?
Never heard of it.
Actually, let me go back a little bit. Did you know Citrix was still in business?
It's a little bit harsh.
Of course they are.
Yes.
They obviously have enough money to spend $2 billion on a company that looks like a bunch of kids out of San Francisco decided to copy Microsoft Office into something. I struggled with the website. There's so much going on that webpage. I found it really difficult to understand what Ryke was.
There's a lot of verbiage without a lot of detail. I guess they compete with the likes of like Slack, Teams, Atlassian. So it's like project management tools. Apparently, there's a lot of talk about employee collaboration and so on. It also looks like they do things like letting managers track a project process through a variety of stages.
Yeah, it seems to be sort of like a cross between Microsoft Project, Microsoft Word, there's Excel in it for project scheduling. They've got a digital assets management. So if you're a marketing person and you're trying to track videos and graphics files, and there's that in there as well. I think I saw a kitchen sink, and the shoe I lost a couple of weeks ago seems to be over there in the professional services section. I don't know. Pretty sprawling thing. And interesting that Citrix feels that if they bundled it up with its technology, that it would be able to leverage to extract $2.25 billion worth of value out of it. I guess financially, Citrix must have the money after selling off some BUs recently. And easy to raise finance, perhaps, because they didn't pay a lot. They didn't use their own money for it.
Well, here's the thing. They're taking out a $1.45 billion unsecured bridge loan from JP Morgan Chase to help them get the cash for this. So, that's a huge loan, but I guess interest rates are really low. So I guess if you're going to take a loan, this is the time to do it. Is Ryke really worth $2.25 billion?
Yeah, well, you're talking something like the pricing talks about $25 per month per person. So I guess you can pretty quickly do the numbers. Like, you know, the old days of you paying $400 for 5 years worth of Microsoft Office, that's gone.
Yeah.
You know, and in the old days that we sort of like, you know, $400 over 5 years, you know, if you take the net present value, that's like $500 maybe. So you're sort of saying it was like $10 a month. And what these people have done is brought this into the web browser, added some extra things around it, and then tripled the price fundamentally. So it's Microsoft Office, but three times the price. So I guess you don't have to have a whole lot of customers to be making a profit. It's all done remotely on someone else's servers. So really, you know, I guess it's all profit, isn't it, really? Once you've built it, it's just, you know, good to go.
Yeah, and it seems like Citrix, you know, I always had them sort of in the application delivery controller box, but it seems like the bulk of their business is now collaboration or remote work enhancement software. So they're virtual desktops and virtual apps and stuff. So I guess they're doubling down on it with this acquisition of Ryke.
Well, they have their SD-WAN as well, of course, which is in the infrastructure space that we know. The Citrix Workspace, which is the thin client, which of course has had a bit of a renaissance with the remote working piece. They already have a Citrix content collaboration piece, which is digital transformation with unified access. So they must have some tools already in the collaboration space that makes them think that that's where the future is. And maybe this is the next step. So if you're a, you know, thin client, remote working, maybe the thing is to add a tool to it. Because Microsoft's doing something similar with Azure. They're selling, you know, Microsoft desktops with, you know, remote access to them. And then you get access to the Office suite. And then you have the collaboration tools. I know that Cisco's WebEx is trying to attempt to get more into the collaboration space, claiming that, you know, pivoting around the idea that if you're going to talk on WebEx used for calls and voice, then having a collaboration tool like collecting meeting minutes. You know, they have the audio transcription, which collects meeting minutes from a call and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess these people are all trying out ideas, but a $2.2 billion, you know, testing out an idea seems incredibly ambitious to me. So
it does.
But as you say, they're not paying for it. They took a loan, unsecured. So,
Yeah. So let's put some context around this, because they also, Citrix also announced their Q4 and full year financial results. For the fourth quarter, they had revenues of $810 million, which was flat, and total revenues for the full fiscal year were $3.24 billion, up 8% over last year. And if you break that out by business units, their workspace unit, which is that virtual desktop and content collaboration, they had revenues of $2.4 billion, up 13%. So clearly Citrix sees this as the future going forward. Their app security and delivery unit, that's the application delivery controller, the SD-WAN part of the business, that declined quarterly and for the full year. The full year revenue was just $721 million, down 4% year over year. Mm. So you can see the balance there and how it's really shifting toward collaboration and virtual desktops.
Yeah, I think Citrix in the infrastructure space never really took off. They had the application delivery controller, but failed to capitalize on that. And it was very good. But F5 continues to maintain control. A10, of course, has moved more into the service providers. There's a bunch around the edge. A lot of the application delivery controllers turned into security companies. And I don't think, you know, they turned into firewall, security, threat detection, malware, you know, that sort of stuff.
They also went software. In their financial results, Citrix actually says that the shift from hardware to software in the ADC space will, quote, create pressure, unquote, on revenues in this business unit. So, you know, the rise of Nginx and then Avi Networks, which VMware picked up, doing all that ADC and load balancing stuff in software, has been hurting Citrix.
Yeah, well, this is also the same issue that Cisco's got as they stop selling really overpriced x86 computers as custom hardware. You lose that revenue up front. You know, today you sell it for $150,000 for a proprietary box with software on it, and you know, and it's just made out of commodity components. And then you shift to charging a customer $5,000 a month. You lose that revenue up front, but it's spread out over a longer period of time. And so this is what you see with Cisco, is its revenue is dropping, but its accrued sales around subscription licensing is increasing. Nobody knows, you know, whether the loss of revenue now offsets the future revenue, but, you know, smarter people than us generally believe that it does.
Yeah, so I guess my big takeaway is that Citrix is essentially becoming a software as a service company, focusing the majority of its business around remote work and collaboration.
No, probably not a bad choice, but it's got to differentiate somehow, I think. And is it being the second best to Azure, you know, or Microsoft? Is that a viable market? I don't know. And, you know, I guess anybody could do a better job of selling Reich than Reich themselves, because boy, oh boy, that website is.
Yeah, it's bad.
That is a San Francisco special right there.
All right. Well, links in the show notes if you want to check it out for yourself. We'll move on. Red Hat, they have announced that starting February 1st, 2021, Red Hat Enterprise Linux will be available at no cost to users for up to 16 production servers. This move comes after Red Hat took fire from the open source community for changes it made to the free CentOS distribution.
Yeah. So this is, you know, we took away your free version, so we'll give you a SOP to make you feel good. We'll give you a free version for 16 instances. Does that make you feel better, Drew? It's gone from all free to just 16 of them free.
It's not a great consolation prize.
It's not really. But I guess if you were thinking about it from the point of view, like I was using CentOS at home, now you can have 16 instances. I call this a sucker pack. You know, you give something the first taste free, and then once you've got it going and it's deployed and it's on the ground, then everything after that gets a bit out of hand. This is probably a net positive for Red Hat overall, in the sense that, you know, for all the people who are whining that I can't use CentOS at home, well, now they can use RHEL, which is probably okay. But then RHEL also gets your details, right? They get the data, they get the analytics, who you are, what you're using, how much you're using it, license compliance. Like, you, every time the servers boot, they'll go and report the licenses to Red Hat's cloud servers. And if you go over it, no doubt the Red Hat sales team will be on the phone encouraging you to Oracle up. I mean, to review your licensing and reach compliance.
You know, actually, I think I read something maybe in the Ars Technica story about this, that Red Hat is promising that if you're using this, you know, 16 free pack, they will not follow up with a sales call. That is a written guarantee. So hopefully they stick with that.
So, Yeah, they say that now.
Right.
Yeah. That was Oracle 10 years ago. Yeah, don't worry about it. We'll just use it and it'll be fine. And then all of a sudden they sent the lawyers in. So I think, you know, it's a balance. IBM hat, you know, Red Hat taking over IBM. It has to deliver a return on the phenomenal amount of money. Was it a $20 billion purchase or something?
It was jaw-dropping. I don't remember the exact number.
But I also think Red Hat does have to refresh itself in some ways. Like that idea of giving away the entire version of Red Hat for free, but having it upstreamed and then it comes into RHEL doesn't make sense. They should be slipstreaming. The way they've done the slipstreaming makes sense at a technical level. And I think it also makes sense at a sales level. So it will certainly increase Red Hat revenues to my mind, but it also makes sense at a technical level to slipstream into the, you know, the way they're slipstreaming the new code, which is coming in. They talked specifically about Facebook wants to see them, wants to give them more patches and more input, and they want to take advantage of that. But In the previous model with CentOS, there are people who couldn't add to it for various reasons. And so I think there's both a technical reason, and I think they're leveraging that for the sales reason. And this is probably, to my mind, a reaction to you're taking away the stuff that I used to use, so I'll just go to Ubuntu because it was free. Mm-hmm. Well, they're going to say, well, you can have 16 instances, but they're going to have data on you. That's the fact. If you're going to use the commercial products, they're going to track you, even if it's free.
We've got another story later in the show, following on this theme of the Durmstrang in the open source market, this intersection of open source and business models and money. So we'll follow up on that, but just a little tip that's coming. And Red Hat's not the only one experiencing these waves. But we'll move on. Cisco, they're warning their SD-WAN customers about two software vulnerabilities that could allow remote command execution that will either allow root privilege execution or could crash the target device. Cisco has released software fixes and says no other workarounds are available. Customers can also upgrade to a fixed software release. The bugs are in the iOS XE SD-WAN software, and that runs on a variety of devices, including VEdge routers, VEdge cloud routers, and the SD-WAN vManage software.
I think the reason that I picked this out, Drew, is that we've seen SD-WAN have bugs of this class fairly regularly every month, I want to say. We don't bring them onto the show every month because it gets a bit repetitive. But these flaws are 9.9 out of 10, 9.8 out of 10 on the CVSS scale. These are fundamental problems, and they spread across the iOS XE SD-WAN software, the SD-WAN vBond orchestrator, SD-WAN vEdge cloud routers, vEdge routers, vManage software, and the controller software, the vSmart controller software. So I take this as a signal, and I've been critical of Cisco's lax software development practices that let it just seemingly publish security vulnerabilities at will, like, and then not get too bent out of shape about it because customers don't seem to care. But so... And then I said a couple of weeks ago, maybe Cisco's putting more effort in here. Apparently not.
Well, I will say that it was Cisco internal security research who discovered this bug, so it wasn't an outside researcher. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's a one little feather in the Cisco cap for this.
I think the SolarWinds thing might have given people a little bit of a scare. You know, do you wonder?
I would hope.
Yeah, like they're looking at SolarWinds and just how bad that has been for them reputationally. We don't know what the long-term damage will be. I suspect it'll be nothing. You know, if I'm Cisco and my whole share price is built around my reputation, not actually the money that I make as much as my reputation for being a stable, reliable, trusted partner, I think if it was Cisco that had that sort of breach, the reputational damage would be much more substantial, whereas SolarWinds is not in the same situation, I don't think.
I would hope that every software company out there would look at their software supply chain, their development practices, their secure software development practices in light of SolarWinds and be like, let's just take a careful look here. Let's make sure everything's on the up and up.
Yeah. But who knows? I mean, in an organization like Cisco, if you had a breach of that depth, there's a fair chance that would be a career limiting maneuver. And you might actually have a regenerating an event as a result of it if it got through on your product, you know, or in your development team or in your whatever. Cisco's pretty harsh when it comes to that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah. So they want to be careful. All right, a quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, Palo Alto Networks. Multitudes of employees are working remotely now, and that means your networking and security infrastructure have to make corporate resources available 24/7 and provide an optimal user experience. And these trends do not appear to be temporary. In fact, 76% of global workers want the option to continue working remotely for at least part of the time. But moving to a predominantly remote workforce strains your existing infrastructure, and organizations are grappling with the limitations of their current architectures in scalability, security, and performance. Palo Alto Networks wants to help you scale your remote workforces without compromise. You can enable secure access from anywhere with Palo Alto's Prisma Access, a cloud-delivered Tier 1 network service. Prisma Access delivers comprehensive network security in a single services edge platform designed for all traffic, all applications, and all users. You can find out more at paloaltonetworks.com/secure-remote-workforces. That's paloaltonetworks.com/secure-remote-workforces. And we thank Palo Alto for being a sponsor. Right, I teased this earlier, but there is operatic drama in the open source software world as data analytics company Elastic, they developed the popular Elasticsearch and Kibana tools, has announced a new dual licensing scheme that essentially makes these products closed source.
So echoes of what happened with MongoDB a while back, where they decided that AWS was taking their software and monetizing it and not giving anything back to the open source project behind it, taking all the money and giving nothing back. Elasticsearch / Kibana has basically decided to do the same thing. And they've adopted the same license as MongoDB, which is the SSPL. Originally, they started claiming that the SSPL was an open source license. And the open source society promptly released an email, a blog post saying, it is most absolutely not. This is a closed source license. It is not in keeping with the open source movement.
Right.
The SSPL license essentially says, you may not use the license work to provide an Elasticsearch as a service offering. Hello, AWS. You may not hack the software to enable our paid features. This refers to they decided to say you could have the Elasticsearch of the time, but we're going to add paid features. And then what AWS did said, well, we'll just reverse engineer those features and add them to the product. Mm-hmm. They basically copied what mm-hmm. Elasticsearch did. Mm-hmm. And then they also say you may not remove, replace, or hide the Elastic branding trademarks from the product. So AWS has, and others have obviously taken the Elasticsearch product, removed the Elastic branding, saying this is an open source project and I can claim it as my own, just in case they have decided to do that. And of course, AWS now declares that it, in the interests of the community, it is forking the project to keep it open.
Right.
And Elastic would come back and say, but AWS has been stealing their ideas and taking their customers for some time, and so on and so on and so on. It's just a typical thing, you know, that we've seen before.
Yeah, I mean, this is the tricky bit about open source when you want to try to build a business around it as a company like Elastic, where you've got this project you created, mm-hmm. you know, you offer it open source to attract developers and attract users and then build a proprietary version or whatever that you're selling feature, you're selling service around, but somebody else can come along like AWS did and take the open source software and build a big smashing business out of it. And Elastic is kind of left holding the bag. We know that AWS has a kind of reputation for taking open source projects and not doing a lot of contribution back. So there's a conflict here for sure.
And yeah, AWS will point to projects that it's put into open source. But that's like open sourcing by a doggy bag, you know, by a doggy poo bag. There you go. Here's an open source project and then dropping it on the ground, right?
Right.
Take the dog poop, put it in. It's like they don't commit people to building a community, to keeping it going. Somewhere in the back, there's some developers who are still pushing out code, but there's no engagement. There's no listening to what's going on outside of AWS, that sort of stuff, which actually makes, which really, well, I feel is the heart of open source in that they listen to everybody and take other people's input to come up with changes and adaptations, whereas AWS is much more of a, we are focused on this goal and this target, targeting this outcome. We're not going to change the way that we work. And flip side of it is, it has to be said that Elastic is listed on the New York Stock Exchange, gets $500 million of revenue from the efforts of over 1,500 contributors to its product. Uh-huh. So, you know, if it wants to stand on its high ground and say, you know, they're making money out of my open source project, and you are too. But AWS also gets to stand on a soapbox and claim some moral high ground by saying, we're saving you from, you know, I think this is just something that is there's no winners here, and certainly not customers.
Yeah, it's weird to see AWS taking the moral high ground by saying, you know, we're going to fork this project and release it under the Apache 2 license to make it fully open source, and we're the heroes and Elasticsearch is the bad guy. And I sort of think Elastic in this move thought that folks would rally around them as we're the little guy being picked on by the big guy, but it kind of in some way seems to have blown up in their faces a lot. They're getting a lot of flack from the open source community about changing the license agreement.
Well, a lot of people put the efforts in to build Elasticsearch. So certainly the company, you know, which is built out of the founders, but taken in the efforts of hundreds and hundreds of people who, you know, one article was I read to sort of get some insights into this was pointing out that if you work on an open source project that requires you to sign a license, a contributor's license, an open contributor's license, that's not an open project, because they're saying every time you contribute something, you're giving away the license rights to the code that you've committed to mm-hmm. the project. Mm-hmm. And Elastic was one of those. Now, I will note that when I go and look at Elastic's board, you will notice that there are a number of Cisco executives, ex-Cisco executives there. And Cisco, of course, is well known for its almost open but mostly proprietary approach to its products as a way to sort of say, we're open, but really once you're into our products, you're sort of you're locked in.
Right.
And I can't help but wonder if the board, and this is very much a board thing. This is one of those times where the CEO or the people at the top actually make the decision that actually has an impact that can change the direction of a company. It happens a couple of times a year for any given organization. And the people who are on the boards all look like these closed type people who don't really understand open source. So I suspect that they're the people who are pushing for it because they think the company needs to, you know, meet up with its obligations and so forth. So they're pushing to get more money out of the company for less work.
Yeah, Elastic put out a blog, and we'll link it in the show notes, where they sort of walk, they have a FAQ where they walk through all the licensing changes and stuff, and you can see them splitting hairs between open and open source, because you need to split those hairs. But that's the kind of thing that really sort of just sullies the whole open source ideal when you're like, yeah. Well, we're open, air quotes, but not open source, but be open is still good. Because, and it's just, all just gets very gross and
which
ugly.
Which tends to come across as, we want you to give us the code for free, you know, your contributions for free so that we can exploit
them. The money.
So, you know, when AWS comes along and says, you know, we're going to take your code, fork it back from the last one, and then maintain a parallel fork, you can't kind of claim, do you know?
Right, right. I mean, in some ways, AWS is doing to Elastic what Elastic does to community developers who contribute code but essentially get nothing but open source software out of Elastic. So it's this money and business model issue that we were just talking about with Red Hat. Once money gets involved, then it just kind of poisons the well.
And ultimately, open source projects at a certain size need to have money to sustain them.
Sure, right.
The Linux Foundation can take them up to a certain size, you know, but the Linux kernel, for example, which is, you know, does work, but it just gets, you know, billions of dollars of money added to it in various forms.
Right.
And it's not that you can't point at that and say that's a way forward. You do need these commercial organizations propelling these products forward. So it's going to be an ongoing thing. I don't see this as a way out. I definitely feel AWS is gilding the lily in their favor, and Elasticsearch points at them and says, AWS claims that they took our Elastic code with our support, which that Elastic certainly did not. When AWS took the Elastic code and put it on their site, the Elastic company said, we don't want you to do this. Mm-hmm. This is right. Our product. We don't want you. But they couldn't stop them. So,
right. No, you know, it's open source.
But AWS was claiming that Elastic helped them, and apparently not. So.
Yeah, Elastic's also making noise about trademark violations. So I wonder if this will get to the lawyers at some point, as opposed to just the court of public opinion. We'll see. But
Well, even if it gets to the lawyers, Elastic won't get. You know, that's not a win. That's just Amazon doesn't care.
I wouldn't. I would trying to sue Amazon would be. Oof.
Pushing on.
Yeah, in any case, ton of show notes if you want to get into this kerfuffle. And if you have some insight, you know, this isn't a space I necessarily follow closely, but feel free to follow us up with packetpushers.net/FU if you've got a dog in this fight and be curious to get some audience feedback on this.
Definitely. I did read a bunch of posts on all the views. I think at the end of the day, customers lose.
I guess we can say that, yes.
as is often the case.
Yeah. Right. All right, moving on, a couple more stories before we wrap. First, Google parent company Alphabet is announcing the end of Project Loon. If you remember this, it aimed to use balloons, sophisticated balloons, to provide wireless broadband to underserved areas and communities. The project proved it could be done, but they just couldn't find a way to do it at a reasonable cost or make any money out of it.
All right. So, you know, back in the days when Google used to do these stunt projects, you know, they used to call them their moonshots, and everybody thought they were insane. It's taken about 10 years to prove that, yes, they were stunts, and yes, they were insane. One of the things that I'll observe about this is that, you know, once upon a time, it was cool for tech companies to do stupid things and then brag about it and say, we're the only people that could do this. You know, we want to try them just for this, you know. But in this case, what they're some of the people are pointing out is that when you go and try to build a proprietary networking technology that avoids what, you know, the mass market commoditized 5G, 4G networks that we have out there, or putting fiber in the ground, it's notable that what Google was trying to do was avoid the infrastructure that was in place. It was trying to do an end run around governments. They didn't want to go to governments and say, we, you know, remember they were doing Google Fiber at the time?
Right.
Trying to roll out fiber in the US and running into all of the red tape of the organizations. And I think they thought that if they could get this balloon thing and, you know, then it would give them a way to push the government around. And no, perhaps not. Because it makes me observe that a lot of these tech companies do things and end up taking subsidies from the government. So they reach out for the free handout. So, like, for example, SpaceX will receive between $12 to $18 billion in subsidies for its Starlink satellite program from the U.S. government.
Yep.
Right? That is a lot of money.
That's a good
chunk. Pretty quick. But they absolutely are the first people to kick up a stink when they have to go to the FCC to apply for a license, or when the government puts conditions on them for all sorts of things about Starlink and SpaceX. And yeah, you know, and the whole SpaceX thing is funded by NASA, funded effectively the government. So you need to be fairly careful about this when you look at these things. These projects, they do spin them fairly heavily, but they're really taking free handouts a lot of the time.
Yes, there is that. I also feel like, you know, Google, I guess, as sort of a company culture observation, it's kind of a dilettante, right? It's got so much money from search and serving up ads that it can faff around with other ideas. And if when things get a little bit hard, they're like, eh, who cares? I'm done. Whereas, like, yeah, you know, if Jeff Bezos decided he wanted to build out a fiber broadband network to sell to consumers, he would do it. He would do everything he had to. He would move heaven and earth if he decided this was a business he wanted to be in, because he's essentially got a killer instinct. To me, Google doesn't feel like that kind of company.
Yeah, I don't think Jeff Bezos actually has that sort of impact. I think he just set up a company that has that killer instinct. He set up an organization that knows how to chase after those things and to act like killers on the on his behalf. Like,
yes, oh, sure. Right. But it comes from the top down.
And that's very different to Facebook, where Zuckerberg is truly evil. Like, for example, when Facebook releases something, releases a press release, it's not Facebook that releases it, it's Mark Zuckerberg publishing something on his Facebook page, right? That's genuine evil. If you're the CEO of a company, you're not the person who makes the press release, it's the company.
Right.
But in the case of Facebook, it's always Zuckerberg who says, oh, we decided to take this action. We're going to, you know, remove this content. It's never Facebook's press department, you know, PR department made this press release. It's Zuckerberg who releases it. There's a difference. I mean,
yeah, I think so. All right. In any case, Loon is grounded. Links in the show notes if you want to read about it.
Yeah. And the era of crazy technologies might be coming to a close as these companies start to crash to the ground.
We shall see. All right. Our last story for today's show. Last week, we talked about a lawsuit that VMware had launched against a former executive who is now the CEO of Nutanix. There's an article in Data Center Knowledge citing a legal expert saying that VMware essentially has a weak case.
Yes. So we talked about this last week and suggested that this was a chilling effect. This, what a VMware is effectively saying is, if you're going to leave VMware and go to Nutanix, we're going to come after you with lawyers and make your life sad and miserable. And we thought that the case was pretty weak. Now, somebody from Data Center Knowledge did go out and actually engage an employment California employment lawyer who confirmed that this is most likely about scaring existing VMware employees. So kind of scummy and probably signals two things. One, it signals that Nutanix must be a bigger competitor to VMware than I previously thought, because it seems to be the Nutanix thing, not the fact that all the other executives who went to Intel and, you know, a storage company, all the other executives walking out the door. Yeah, no lawyers on those. And it's definitely, you know, to try and stop, obviously, there's a, you know, is there a lot of people leaving VMware to go to work for Nutanix? Is Nutanix recruiting inside of VMware? Is VMware not paying their people enough, not looking after them enough? Is VMware dysfunctional enough that they think calling in the lawyers will stop this happening? Something's not right here, and we'll be looking to see what we can find.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, like you said, my take last week was this was a scare tactic for other employees and also a nuisance to an upstart competitor that VMware is competing against and wanted to give him a hard time. So, It seems like that may be the case because the lawyer that Data Center Knowledge interviewed said, yeah, this is not a strong case for VMware.
If I was an employee at VMware, I'd be thinking seriously about leaving. This would be a flag, you know, a signal that something's not right somewhere.
Maybe wait till the lawsuit settles and see how it goes.
Yes. So I'm in two minds here. I think VMware's got great products and has historically been a great organization, and they've got a bright future, but there must be something wrong when this sort of stuff goes on.
Yeah, it's kind of a bullying move. In any case, that does wrap up our news portion. Stay tuned for our sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with Apneta on building user monitoring and end user experience. That's coming right up. Welcome to the Tech Bytes podcast from the Packet Pushers. You may have noticed that it can be difficult to define good or bad application performance, despite the fact that there's a huge number of tools that are supposed to do just that. Measuring app performance is even harder now that lots of employees are working outside the office. So we're talking today with sponsor Apneta about getting real-time monitoring in place so that you can define good performance, actually measure it from the end user perspective, and have a strategy to make sure those benchmarks are met. Our guests from Apneta are John Tufik, he is Director of Global Alliances, and Seth Differ, Senior Manager Solutions Consulting. John and Seth, welcome to the podcast. So why is there such a disconnect between what IT understands about user experience and what end users are actually experiencing?
We believe the disconnect is because of really shifting expectations of performance. I think that there's been a bit of a continuum of expectations as people started to work from anywhere at scale. And as we were first encountering this with our customers, there was, I think, higher tolerances of applications working successfully and even people getting into rhythms of being able to perform their job duties successfully. However, now I think as we've matured in this, we've reached a point where those expectations have swung back to a higher demand on how applications are going to work and how they're going to be successfully delivered. And so IT is at a bit of this unfair sort of disadvantage of not quite having this clear picture, because the goalposts are moving a little bit, of what the expectations actually are.
It's also confusing too, because a lot of people have consumer expectations of their technology. They use their smartphones, you know, their apps produced by these multi-billion dollar enterprises who only do one thing. And they, you mm-hmm. know, and these multi-billion dollar companies who have one app like Facebook. And then they go, why is my corporate app not benchmarking the same? And the answer is, of course, the apps are not at all the same. They don't have the same level of focus, the same level of investment, the same sort of commitment to them. Because an accounting app inside of your enterprise is used by 20 people, not by a billion people worldwide. And there's a gap, but their expectation is this sets the benchmark. Why is my enterprise not running the same?
I think that's true. I think in our personal lives as well, I mean, I've become less tolerant as well in even in voice and video delivery of how this should work, just based on my personal experiences, because I think we are now becoming more and more dependent, especially now, on using video and voice to connect and have that connection. And in my personal life, I'm using it just as much, if not more, than in my professional life. And the expectations now are kind of shifting to being like, this just needs to work. I always need to be able to have this high quality voice, high quality video to be able to have a connection.
Yeah. But I think part of the issue is that, you know, IT was sort of built out with the understanding that everybody's going to be pretty much in one place. We control the environment. We can set it up to provide that good experience. And now everyone's everywhere. And who knows, you know, what quality network and infrastructure and tools they have. And so how does IT, you know, how are they actually able to get an accurate view given that everyone's everywhere and IT has no control over what they're using?
So there's a wide array of areas that we can look at to start to accumulate this information. We can baseline our metrics. We can understand what loss is, but we can't look at these metrics in a singular vacuum because we don't know what good or bad is. So we need to understand what's provided by the application service provider. We need to potentially look at things like CDR records, and we need to mix in the measurements from monitoring tools. And somewhere in the middle of that, we'll be able to triangulate and define what good is in that user environment. You know, as you mentioned, Drew, users are working from anywhere. They might be on Wi-Fi, they might be on wired. They could be connecting to a UCaaS solution that's backhauled across their data center environment, or they could be going direct to internet. So we need to initially start to baseline these metrics and then compare and contrast that against what's provided by the service providers to understand what is good.
I think there's also just what end users see and what the network sees, which is what we're talking about here. This gap between the network and what the user sees has become very different in the sense that you could be measuring packet performance using, say, flow data from the routers, but that's still not going to measure the end user experience. That's measuring the network experience. You still need to measure the network experience. You still need a tool that's going to do that, but you're also going to want something that comes from the handset, because you can't ask the user, and this is what it really comes down to, is, "Hi, Seth, is your app running fast or slow?" And you know,
I don't
know. Answer, yeah, sure. 4 times out of 5, the answer will be slow. Wouldn't matter if it was faster or slow. They'd just give you the, you know what I mean? So I think the reality here is actually getting metrics on getting a proper view. It's not, when we say accurate, I think what we need is something that actually says it's real. Like, it's based off hard data, and that gives you an accurate outcome.
I like that. I like the idea of a proper view, because we're not naive enough to believe that IT is all in on a single platform that solves all their problems. You know, if that existed, we wouldn't need to talk about why we provide value in a very particular way. What I think we've come up against now, and Drew, you alluded to this, is that there are things that you control, there are things that you have visibility over, and then there are all the things that you don't. Those are the variables of wherever that end user is and whatever networks that end user traverses. And so there is an ecosystem of data. And one of the pieces of that data is to truly understand it from the end user perspective. All the other things, like you had mentioned, Greg, was, you know, you've got flow data, you've got an understanding of what's coming into the data center or what's going through your POP. That's not going away. You need that. You need to understand that for the very big things and big shifts that are happening inside the network. But also you need an understanding of all those other pieces and interdependencies that get that application all the way to the end user.
Yeah, what you really want is, and this is what AppNeta leads us into, is this: the help desk gets a call from somebody saying the application's running slow. And the help desk person, the frontline help desk person, can click a button and immediately see what the end user's experience is and go like, okay, you're looking for a day off work, you know, maybe. Or maybe something is running slow. You don't necessarily know what, but you know what the end user's experiencing. And so then you know, oh, yeah, okay, we'll actually log a call for this because I can see that something's running slow. Or, yeah, hi, Susie, we know that you were hammered last night and you don't want to work this morning, but you know what.
you mentioned the idea that you want to find out if it's real, and I think that that's true too.
Yeah.
You know, just an anecdote on the idea of the shifting expectation. One of the areas that we're hearing about the shifting expectation is from VIP escalations, that there's a VIP user, they've escalated an experience issue, and when we work with IT teams, what this becomes is a swarm of IT personnel, and this is honest story, 4 hours on the phone with an end user troubleshooting their home internet connection. That doesn't scale well, obviously.
No.
And everybody's losing a lot of time. And the difference is taking that, where you're not exactly sure where it is and you're getting the user to try this and that, to having this instant insight as to whether it's a real problem, like from hours to the scale of a minute. Just like you said, the help desk or anybody looking at this actually has some data. Did it change? Was it better yesterday? Is it worse now? Did it change this morning?
Yeah.
How do I actually prove that it's real?
It's this under troubleshooting and over troubleshooting. If you don't troubleshoot it, under troubleshoot, then you might actually be ignoring a real problem. And if you over troubleshoot it because you don't have enough data, you're just wasting resources. That's actually a spectrum of pain. Right. Yeah. Although I've always believed that VIP should be given the worst level of service, because that's the best way to get investment.
IT dollars. Yeah.
I won't tell you the story behind that, but that actually does work. And anyway, you're going to say, Seth.
You know, a lot of times what we find is after those 4-hour troubleshooting calls that John was mentioning, belief is in a blind spot to blame what you can't see, right? Mm-hmm. So now users are working from anywhere. They don't know if they're connected to wireless or wired, and if they're on a DSL link or maybe connecting over their LTE modem, these IT organizations have the flow visibility, as you mentioned earlier. They might be able to run pings and trace routes and, you know, talk to their carrier, but they're not able to solve that problem. And they just put it on the user saying, well, user's event or user environment might have been the cause here, and close the ticket and move on till the next time it happens again tomorrow. So
there was some stubbornness here. This is actually an interesting thing. There's some stubbornness around a belief that it must be what you can't see. It must be the part that you don't understand. Seth and I both worked with an enterprise client that brought us in to absolutely prove, because they were sure. They brought us in to prove that the issue was home internet connectivity. It absolutely wasn't. It was the connectivity between the VPN concentrator into the data center. That's where we actually used our technology end to end to prove that it was upstream between the VPN concentrator and inside the data center. But they were so sure it was what they couldn't see. It actually took a lot of work just to get them into a belief system where that we could show them that it is not the part that you suspect just because you can't see it.
Yeah. So what then should IT be looking at? Is there sort of a standard set of things that IT should be measuring to make sure they're getting an actual valid view of user experience?
I think it boils down to, and we talked about this ecosystem of data, I think what it boils down to is making sure you have observability end to end. So if you don't have that, then you're going to have these blind spots that obviously could be the source of problems, but just as much as you're trying to prove whether or not that area that you were blind to might be the problem, you also need to as quickly rule it out. So you have to have an end-to-end ecosystem, and that's really the primary basis of our technology and our value, is that we're trying to measure end-to-end from wherever the user is consuming these services. And layered on top of that is an ecosystem of other pieces of information to tell that whole story. But I think end-to-end observability is really what it boils down to.
Okay, so that tells me a client on the endpoint?
That's right. It could be in many cases that, as they work from anywhere. And of course, they're going to be shifting back to the office at some point, or there's going to be sort of a changing way in which the office, traditional office, will be used moving forward.
Serviced offices,
so we have to have these,
shared facilities rather than, some sort of, remote office capability that's shared, or you rent and you just turn up for a day and go for a day,
Exactly. So we have to have a lot of flexibility in where we instrument, because we need to be able to instrument sort of at that sort of variable level, right at the end user's machine, at the branch office, whether it be something that's permanent or not, in the POP, in the data center, in the cloud. We need to have that versatility so that we can get that end-to-end picture.
I did some time in a WeWork, and the internet was appalling. And every time I logged a call with their helpline, they refused to do anything about it because they said no one else was complaining. Now, obviously, I couldn't get everybody else to complain, but what I did do was produce some data that showed them how bad it was, and they went, oh, okay.
It's real.
It's real, right? Now, but if you've signed up for one of these organizations for renting offices or, hot desking or whatever, they're going to do nothing unless something's shoved in their face, and they're going to try and cut corners as much as possible. It's a real problem, I think.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. My wife works for a higher education company, and they use a contact center platform that's integrated with the CRM. Anyway, they have this issue when they make a voice call where it doesn't hang up and it still continues to ring. So I finally had her show it to me, and it is more of an annoyance than anything else. It's not going to prevent them from doing their jobs. But she's been doing a great job of documenting that, recording audio recordings, notes, things like you said, Greg, that you had mentioned in WeWork. And she just asked me straight up one day, shouldn't this just work? I don't understand why I can't get this resolved quickly. And I let her know, take it to a director or a VP level, and they will soon be able to get that issue resolved for you. So, it's you need that groundswell of support and a lot of metrics being collected from these different environments that John had talked about to push it back onto
data talks,
the ISPs or your provider of that internet for the day that you're using. So
we sort of started this conversation saying that kind of the gold standard of performance was the office environment where IT could control everything. Is that still what organizations should be using as the sort of baseline measure now that there's so few users in the office, or do we need to set a new baseline? What would IT teams do?
I think this question has some healthy debate to it. And I think it's a debatable question depending on sort of where you are in terms of your IT strategy. Because on the one hand, it absolutely can be the gold standard because this still represents the highest level of investment in terms of your connectivity and delivery to applications, in terms of the things that you can control, the service providers you use, the technologies you use at the edge. This represents your highest investment. So there should really be no expectation that it can do better than that in those cases. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, there's also going to be a changing sort of landscape of how the office is used in the first place. So, of course, the office should perform quite perfectly if there's nobody in it. How do you then kind of come up with that in between? Well, I do think that you need a control. So that is really the message at the end of the day, is that you need a control, whether or not you're using branch offices as the control or using outside in monitoring that are not to do with your user community as the control. You need some control group to be able to baseline against, because there's it's never going to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And you have to really know what's achievable and be able to measure what is achievable through that control group, and then compare your end user community to that.
So maybe the vice president becomes the control group, whatever he or she is getting.
Unless we use Greg's tactic of underinvesting.
It really works. There's nothing like a budget increase when the CEO gets, you just say, like, oh, that's how it works. That's all it gets. That's all we got, you know.
It's the best we can do.
It's the best we can do. It's like, oh.
As a pro tip for you. So if folks want to find out more about Appneta, John and Seth, where would you send them?
You can find us at Appneta on all social and at our blog at appneta.com, and finally at appneta.com/packetpushers.
Well, that does wrap up our time. Thank you, John and Seth, for joining us, and thanks to Appneta for being a sponsor. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog. That's at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.